Okay, welcome to Biblical Conflict Resolution. Let's set some ground rules or principles to begin with. We can't really talk about conflict resolution without setting some parameters to really realize what should be the goal or whatever. The point of conflict resolution is reconciliation. And it's so important to emphasize, because we tend to go into conflict resolution with the mindset of, I need to win. And things have to end up the way, before we even go into the process, I want it to be, and anything else is failure. Well, okay, yes, then everything will be failure, because the point of biblical conflict resolution is reconciliation. It's not winning. Does that mean you sacrifice all of other principles or whatever? No, there's a reason there's a conflict. There's stuff to work on. But the point is reconciliation. And let me point out that we're talking conflict. We're not talking an argument. Real conflict means it's an ongoing issue. You didn't disagree about one thing once. That's an argument. It is, we have a hard time working together. We have a hard time getting along. And sometimes biblical or conflict resolution, a conflict resolution principle in general becomes necessary, even if, yeah, mechanically things are working. It's just, I hate going to work, or I hate being home, or I hate being with my kid because we're in conflict. It's about the reconciliation. But it implies it's an ongoing relationship. That said, there will be some of the things we'll talk about today that you can use in a specific argument as well, of course. Biblical conflict resolution, yes, the Bible has many passages that talks about how to resolve conflict. One of the big passages that outlines a lot of this is in Matthew 18. A lot of this is outlined there, with a lot of details added in for other biblical passages. I'll give you some tools that I use clinically in my therapy, within families, within couples, or just teach individuals. Yes, I'm a therapist. I'm a clinical psychologist. Don't you all leave at once. You can still talk safely. I won't psychoanalyze you. Not out loud. yes. So, but let me also point out this, which is very important in context. Biblical conflict resolution, I already said, is about reconciliation. The entire Bible is about reconciliation. The entire Bible is about reconciliation. The Bible starts with creation, but towards the end of creation, we enter in. And then, within the same page, we have conflict. And God offers options for reconciliation, except that's not the route we take. And then the rest of the Bible has been, from then, is in the end about reconciliation between God and us. And God keeps making biblical reconciliation efforts, and we keep messing it up. But it's also a good model. Sometimes, even though someone else is the one that's on the wrong side, or having done the harm, or having done the wrong action, that doesn't mean that the other person can't do anything. That's all God is doing, is reaching out. Did God make a big mistake in his relationship with us? Does he keep messing stuff up? No, but does he still reach out? Yeah. Does he still make sacrifices? Yeah, he made a huge sacrifice. He nailed something precious to a tree or let that happen. Yeah, that was Christ, right? So, the whole Bible is an example of biblical reconciliation. It's not, which I love about this topic in that sense, because there's a lot of topics we can take out of the Bible and say, biblical physical health or whatever. Okay, that's great, but it's usually, you know, draw a few passages here and there. But for this topic, in the end, the whole Bible is about it. Okay, so let's talk about some steps to biblical conflict resolution. Okay. Step one is self-examination. There's a lot of Bible passages to this one. Like, get the log out of your own eye. Probably the most frequently quoted one, right? You have to look at that. And it usually boils down to what's your idols that are involved in this situation. Okay. Audience participation. What's some idols you could see getting in the way of resolving conflict with someone?
Pride.
I'm important. Or I'm above whatever, right? Okay, well, yeah, he did something big, I did something small, but I'm above apologizing for that little thing, right? I'm not someone who does that. It's not my fault. Or why should I be the one? Hey, I mean, I'm the manager, right? So he's the one who has to. Yeah, pride. What else? Yes?
Need to be in control.
I need to be in control. And that's one of the hardest things about conflict resolution. You're not in full control of the process. You can't plan it all out to the detail where I know what to say and this will work. There's someone else in it. And even a lot of conflict is based on, I'm in general not willing to give up control. In that I might have an employee or a wife or a child or a friend who wants some say in what we're doing. Yeah. Okay, great one. Great one. What else?
You think too much of the other person. You think that they should be, you know, perfect. And then the reality of their faux pas and different things hit you. How could they be so disappointing?
Yes, they're on a pedestal,
yes.
Right? And what you're saying, that it totally goes into a different point, is as you said, they fell for that from that pedestal. And the real reason you have a conflict and problem here is not actually because what they did was so bad. It's because it's so different from who you thought they were. Or other times, conflict comes from looking at people. Very often, this is pastors. For me, this has been professors and senior students in the past. When I was younger and going through parts of my education, I used to think of those people as just, they were their role and they were perfect and they weren't human beings with feelings behind stuff. So I approached ways and asked more questions than I probably should because I didn't realize it might not feel good to be asked the level of detail I'm asking. It's going to seem like challenging or whatever. Yeah, sometimes if we treat people as not people. Yeah. By the way, that's one of the most stressful things for pastors and being pastors, because people do expect that. And if pastors are perfect, they're unrelatable. If they have flaws, they're sinful and not living up to biblical standards, and we shouldn't have that pastor. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to teach a little model that's great for learning ourselves better, and sometimes it's great for figuring out the idols or what's really going on in a conflict, is what's called a frustration model. And I'll draw it on the board, but since some people will be listening in on this recording, I'll be speaking it out loud here. On the left side here, here's you. Here's a little silly stick figure. And I'm going to put an arrow towards a goal, whatever that goal is. You may not even know what that goal is. Now, this is going to become important because everyone knows what frustration is, but it's really difficult for people to actually explain what is frustration and what leads to frustration. So I'm going to put a barrier here. In the middle of that line of arrow, I'm going to put a little barrier. Something is stopping us from reaching that goal, or something is making it harder to get towards that goal. And arrow off that barrier, leading to frustration. When something gets in the way of something we care about, a goal we're trying to reach, we will feel frustrated. Okay, now that I put up the model, that seems pretty self-explanatory, or that, well, okay, yeah, that totally makes sense. But you can really use this to understand yourself and others and situations better. For example, if you're working towards something and something gets in the way, and you don't get frustrated, it means that's not your goal. You just thought it was your goal. There was something else involved. Or you thought something didn't matter to you. Yeah, that's just something I do for fun. Or yeah, it's not really that important to me. But something got in the way. And now you got frustrated. That tells you, I guess that matters more to me than it should. Well, that's definitely not a goal of mine. That would be an idol. Since something gets in the way and you get frustrated. Yeah, it is, then it is an idol for you. There's one place you sometimes might be able to learn even more for yourself, and that's when you get frustrated, but you're not quite sure why. Well, then it's time to start examining, what are the things I'm working towards and I don't even know it? A couple of examples from my own life and myself. A few of you have had the dubious pleasure of playing board games with me. And among my friends, I'm known to be a very good board game player. Actually, I have a lot of friends that if they play a new game or they're unsure about the best strategy in the game, their strategy is just make it difficult for Espen. Whatever sabotages Espen must be a good strategy, even if you don't know what else, because I'm the presumed winner. But the real secret to me being a good board game player really boils down to the following. Okay, I have a good enough mind. I'll agree to that. But most of the time when I play board games with people, their primary goal is to win the board game. I don't care about winning the board game. Then how come I usually win? Well, I don't care about winning the board game, but I do care about having a good intellectual challenge. And the challenge is trying to win the game. But it's the intellectual challenge that is the goal. So when something in the game goes wrong, or people start sabotaging me, it's not actually interfering with my goal. Yes, it does make it harder to win the game. But it only increased my intellectual challenge. So I'm winning here. But it also means I'm not getting frustrated when I play a board game. And as a result, I'm not making emotional decisions. I can stick with what makes sense. Other example. I'm coming home from work. This was spring many years ago. It had been an insanely busy and stressful and just wear day at work. And I come home and I'm like, I bet dinner's almost ready and there's my wife and daughter is there. They're going to pounce on me as soon as I come in a good way, in a very cheerful, daddy, you're home. Except she would say, papa. But on my way in the driveway, I see, the grass is getting long. Is that time in spring? You have not mowed the grass yet? And I'm like, that is really long. It really needs to be mowed. So I pop my head in. Okay, I'll be in as soon as I mow the grass because it really needs to get mowed. And I go out, and then I realize I need to change the oil on the mower. Because you should do that every season. Mind you, this might be the only time I've ever changed the oil on the lawnmower, but for some reason I thought that's a responsible thing to do. I tried to open the bolt underneath to let the oil out, except I can't even find it, and it's caked underneath now 8-month-old rotten grass, but I eventually find it. It's really stuck. I keep scraping my knuckles trying to open it. And half an hour later, I finally have the oil changed after cleaning up a spill, and then I spend 20 minutes mowing the grass. And as I'm finishing up the grass mowing, I'm realizing, why did I not get frustrated at any point in this process? Because on the surface, what was my goal? Mow the grass. Except I had things getting in the way of mowing the grass. First of all, realizing, I need an oil change. And then it being difficult to do the oil change. 5-minute process took me half an hour. But at no point did I get frustrated. So was mowing my grass the real goal?
No.
No. And I could have mowed it the next day. It's not like magically the grass is starting to hurt people by waiting another day, right? No. What ended up really being my goal? After a really long and stressful day, I was not ready to move into family mode. So the delay became a bonus. Okay? That's what I figured out. Okay? But very often what gets in the way in conflicts and stuff is we have these goals and agendas that we may not even realize we have those agendas. So figuring that out becomes a part of that self-assessment. What is it that I really want? And certainly that includes those idols. I want him to respect me again. I don't need him to respect you. Is that really necessary? That's kind of on the pride thing, but okay. But maybe on a practical level, I don't know. You have to figure that out. The next thing you need to do in the assessment is figure out, and you may not find the answer, but you should at least try this, figure out what is the real reason for our conflict. And do remember, it's not about one behavior, one choice. If someone made one mistake and that's all it is, even if in your mind you think it's one behavior, we usually move past that. There's something underlying or ongoing, or something we dislike about someone or what's going wrong. So we need to figure out, even if we put the blame on, okay, it's on their side of it, what's the reasons for it? Let's problem solve. What are some broad categories why someone might not perform as you would want them to?
Selfishness.
Okay, they may be selfish. And thank you, and I'm really glad you suggested that one first. Because instinctively, that's the one we tend to assume it is. But is it necessarily selfishness? No. But we tend to think it is. Yes?
Being lazy?
They could be lazy. We could argue that's a part of selfishness, but it might not be, right? Yes. Other reasons?
Stubborn.
Stubborn. They are just stubborn. Yes. Okay. Other reasons?
Lack of awareness.
Aha! They lack awareness. Yes. If someone lacks awareness, is that their fault, by the way? No. It's their responsibility, right? It's their responsibility. I like to liken it to you get a huge snowstorm and now you got a foot of snow on your sidewalk and someone and it turns into ice, you know, before you even get up to put it away, right? And someone comes and they slip on it, right? Is it your fault? Yeah. Not really your fault, but is it your responsibility? Yeah. Yeah, it's your responsibility to keep it clean. That's right. Let's say we ended up getting, suddenly we got busloads coming in here and we get twice as many guys as they expected. And as a result for lunch, there's not enough sandwiches. Where we're taking care of the food, is this their fault?
No.
No. Is it a responsibility? Yeah. Just I'm emphasizing those because we sometimes think that fault and responsibility always is the same thing. You can hold someone responsibility without blaming them. Make sense? Okay. Self-aware. Now, lack of awareness. Yeah, they may not even realize something that's underneath there. Yes. Give me another one.
They're stupid.
They're stupid. Right. Right. That's right. And I'm gonna rephrase that one. Insufficient intelligence. Right? We tend to blame someone for being stupid. But if it really is stupid, it's really talking about insufficient intelligence, which most people, if they could take a pill and now they're more intelligent, they would. We would all fix that if we could. Right? Yes. Yes. Okay, give me another one.
No empathy.
No empathy. That's right. And boy, that's a hard one for people. I work with a lot of people with no empathy. And those are actually some of the clients I feel the worst for. Because I'm actually talking about people who, biologically speaking, don't have empathy. I have a lot of clients who would have empathy if they could, except they're not biologically equipped that way. Does that make sense? If it truly is no empathy, they couldn't choose that. By the way, there's two forms of empathy. One is partially biological. The other one is learning or choice. We have an emotional empathy, and that's the ability to feel what someone else feels. To a large extent, that's biologically determined, and you can increase it over time. But there are plenty of people who are born without the ability to feel what other people are feeling. It's usually the same people who biologically can't feel their own feelings. Emotional empathy is feeling what someone else feels. Well, if you can't feel your own feelings, you can't feel yourself feel what someone else feels. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It tends to be the same people. And if it's at that biological level, there's nothing they can do about that. But they can still learn to be good people. They can still employ intellectual empathy. As a therapist, I almost exclusively use intellectual empathy. Intellectual empathy is knowing what you feel and acting accordingly. Why do you use that as a therapist is unfair to my clients otherwise. Because with emotional empathy, my own emotions get too confusing and it's hard to know, is it me feeling bad or is it me feeling what they're feeling? Also, emotional empathy takes a lot longer to reset. It's unfair to my clients to use emotional empathy. Because otherwise, I say goodbye to one client, and in comes the next client, and I still have the emotions from the last client. Doesn't work. It's unfair to the next client. And by the next client again, I'm probably finally moved on from the client before that again, but now I have the new client that I've gotten it in for the next client again. That doesn't work. But it is hard to learn good intellectual empathy if you don't have emotional empathy. Because that becomes one of your best teaching tools for understanding intellectual empathy. But yes, no empathy. I'm just saying no empathy is not actually a reason to put them down. Is a biological thing or is a skill thing? Which brings up the next level. They're lacking in skills. If they're lacking in skills, is it their fault? Yeah, it depends. I mean, it's their fault if they refuse to go to trainings, right? If they were forced to do a job that they've said, this is not what I'm suited for, I was hired for this position and you're making me do that. Yes. My wife does all the sewing in the family, except she gets my daughter to do some. I don't have a son, so she couldn't have made my son do it. I get around a sewing machine, I mess everything up. I have no skills with a sewing machine. Repair a toilet, that's me. I have a little bit more skills with it. Yes, I have crappy skills. Yes. Okay. Going along with insufficient intelligence goes just abilities. You know, their innate beginning abilities may be at issue, or your own abilities in this situation. We can get into circumstance. You know, hey, circumstances set them up for this. Now, usually though, it's a combination of stuff. But we tend to assume things like selfish, lazy, stubborn, mean. They made a choice they knew was wrong because they wanted to. And surely that happens. I'm not saying that's not the case ever. But we need to do an assessment. What are the things that may be the reason for what they're doing? Yes.
Nitpicking. You know,
yeah.
In a relationship, one of them is they just nitpick the other because they're so fussy on some things, and the other person isn't fussy about that.
That's right. And now you get into what does become very huge in any conflict, and that's personality. And even more importantly, personality differences. Is it good to want things to be great? Yeah, that's good, right? It's good. But yes, you put someone in whose level of sufficient greatness is a 10, and they work with someone who's good enough is a 6, they're going to have disagreements. Absolutely. One something that goes along here too is, boy, I need to start hurrying, don't I? Core values. Sometimes our underlying priorities are different from each other. Some people value getting along. Some people value creativity. Some people value being the best you can be. Sometimes it's just our underlying values are different than what we're doing. And we're not talking good or bad values. We're talking all good values. It's just what are the most important for you. Okay. Self-assessment. Spent a lot of time there. Let's move on to the other parts. But that is really central, is that self-assessment and assessment of the situation before you move on. The Bible is then clear. You have to ask yourself, should I move on? We're supposed to ask that. The Bible is very clear on it. Before you start any kind of conflict resolution process is, can I just overlook this? I have something called two-pronged ratings that I use in this context and many other contexts. The first question you should ask yourself is, how big of a deal does it feel? And give it a rating from 0 to 10. 10 being, that's murder. Okay? That's the first part. How big of a deal does it feel? 0 to 10. You need to put down a number, and no number is wrong as long as it reflects your feeling. Oh, it feels like 1,000. No, that is wrong because we maxed it out at 10. And there's no wrong answer. And you can even use this process with other people at times. I use it with my daughter a lot. That's where whatever number is there is what it is. Then the second question comes. How big of a deal is it? And now 0 to 10. And I tell people, you should never, ever do number 2 before you've done number 1 here. Okay? You have to have asked yourself how big of a deal it feels. The emotional part of your brain does not leave space for the rational part of your brain before it has been validated and accepted. On the second rating, yeah, that's where you hold yourself accountable. If you're good at making ratings like this, it gets way easier too. Or you can think yourself, well, let's see, when my dog died last week, that was a 6. And this one felt like a 9, but it really was he broke a $10 vase. I guess maybe that's a 1. Because we get out of proportion with how serious things are. How big of a deal does it feel? Followed with yourself, how big of a deal is it? And if it's a really low number, consider, maybe it just feels big for me and maybe I should move on. Maybe it isn't that big of a deal. Maybe it's me getting stuck on something small. Okay. Next. Oh, and people tend to hate the next one. People hate the next one. But the next one only works if you've done a good assessment, like I talked about, in reviewing the situation with yourself. Next step is help. Wait a minute. I want to confront him. I want to yell at her. I want to point out everything he did wrong. Nope. You help. I come home from work, and I have been working a 10-hour day, and she's been working doing soaps all day, and not the laundry kind of soap, but, you know. And I wish I'd been doing the laundry kind of soap, because guess what? The laundry hadn't gotten done. Well, okay. Is there something going on that she needs help with? Has she been struggling with something emotionally, so it's been hard for her to get to the laundry? It's been hard for her to get out of bed. Okay, then help with that. Has she been really exhausted because over the last week she's been doing 10 ministry events and she does 50 hours of work of volunteering on top of that? Okay, is there something you can help with? Or do they have an issue? Maybe we go back to the skills, the attributes, the awareness, the knowledge. Are there ways you can help them improving this situation. By the way, one thing we did not do on the kind of potential causes list, which is so huge and people just take for granted as being personal and they're bad, social skills. A lot of people don't have social skills or they're really bad. But now it's personal. You don't know how to fix a car, that's forgivable. You have bad car skills, okay. You have bad social skills, you're a bad person. No. But we tend to take it that way. And it kind of makes sense because it makes conflict resolution and everything else harder because it's harder to communicate and deal with them. But maybe their social skills are bad because they don't get enough good social interaction. And if everyone keeps being angry at them for saying the wrong thing, then the social skills probably never get better because they don't get the good social interaction. So help. Are there ways we can help this and help them with what's going on is the first point we're supposed to go to. Some of the biblical language for there is to restore the person so that they're functioning with whatever you see as the issue. Biblical reference, if you wanted, Galatians 6:1. Okay. Next. Converse and discuss. Wait a minute. I figured out that helping doesn't work, or tried helping and it didn't work. I still can't start yelling at the person, or still can't really confront them about what's going on. No. Next time you converse and discuss. You get together and you try to learn more about the situation and what's going on from them. So tell me about your work lately, or how's home life, or I know I'm at work all day and you're at your job, so but what's been going on? How are you? So, sweetie, I love you. You're a great daughter. You're a great son, whatever. Don't say whatever, whether he's son or daughter to your son or daughter, but okay. I've been seeing you haven't been doing much homework lately, and I see your grades are a little less than what they used to. What's going on? Or maybe before even going there, hey, how's life? What's going on? We don't have to jump straight to the confrontations always. Now, this step may include a little bit of confrontation in a gentle way. Just bringing up, hey, I've observed this. I've seen this. Can you help me here? You know, understand this better. What's going on? Next, let's move to the next step. Okay, finally, I can let my frustrations out, right? Yeah. Negotiation. Okay. Negotiation doesn't actually apply in all situations. But negotiations is involved in, okay, we're not always getting along, or things are not going always smoothly. What are some things we can do so it works better? It could be a compromise, right? It could be a compromise. Or how can we move things around so it's not as big of an issue? Or it seems like we're always both frustrated after with having our meetings. Why do you think that is? Well, we always have our meetings at Friday, at the end of Friday, and we're reviewing the week, and then I have to go home, and whatever we talked about, I can't really do anything about it before Monday anyway, and so just keeps mulling on it all weekend. And oh, okay. So when do you think we should do the meetings? Okay, maybe we move the meeting and that works better. Sometimes just things like that. By the way, most couples I work with for couples therapy, is one of the negotiation things we worked out, is they have scheduled arguments. Yeah. Because guess when arguments usually happen? Arguments in a marriage usually happen at the worst possible times. They usually happen when someone, and this also happens with friends and at work and stuff, the arguments usually happens when someone's been pushed really to the limit and they had a bad day and there are no good emotional states to actually talk about it. Or it happens, you're about to sleep. Right? Okay. Worst time. to have it. So a lot of couples, a part of the negotiation, they figure, huh, yeah, I wonder if our relationship will work better if, you know, 4 o'clock every Friday we have our argument. Yeah. Just because it works better. Because guess what? Couples are going to argue, and couples need to argue. Sometimes the couples therapy, the couples that worry about the most, are the ones that never argue. Because it usually means they have all of these issues that are just building up and building up and building up and building up and building up. Does anyone know what's the most typical marriage age? Like for how long the marriage had gone for divorce? It's usually between age 5 and 7 of the marriage. Does anyone know when they knew all the problems? They usually knew all the problems in year 2. They just don't do anything about it. And come 5 to 7, they now start marriage counseling, and it very often doesn't work because those patterns have now been in place for years. And very often the issue is they weren't arguing. It doesn't mean you should have bad arguments, but you need that negotiation. You need that talking. You need that step of conflict resolution every so often, because all marriages and relationships are going to have some conflict. Okay, next step. Bring in a third party to mediate. And I've been asked to come in to mediate at times. That's bringing on a third person you can agree on to come in to help work through the situation, to talk through it. Because you're coming in with your blind spot. The person you're trying to resolve it with is coming in with their blind spots. And you may not even realize it when you're way off. Bring in a third party to mediate. They'll referee, they'll throw a red flag, step out of bounds. Yes, roughing the husband. Yeah, you bring in someone else to do that mediation. What I see in churches, families, companies, organizations, they move to this point way too late. They move into a full-out conflict and argument and stalemate for a long time, and usually bring in the mediator in way too late. If things are not working out without a mediator, people are way too slow to bring that in. But if you bring in a mediator, it has to be someone that both can agree to bring in. Right? Well, yes, my dear daughter, I know you don't agree with me. I'm gonna bring in someone to mediate. I'm gonna bring in my wife and see if she thinks you're gonna have a later bedtime. No, she's gonna stick with me. It's gonna be someone you both can agree is being a fair person there. Next step. It may seem similar to mediate, but it's also different. Just to bring in an arbiter. There's a big difference between a mediator and an arbiter, although in some ways they're similar. They both help resolve a conflict. They both help talk through it. But the mediator has no power except call foul and help guide the conversation to prevent people to get into 10-year-old issues or things that are not related to what's going on, to keep it focused. But they have no power, they have no say. An arbiter is when they've agreed, we need someone else to hear us out, and we both agree to this arbiter, and if we, in the arbitration, we can't figure it out together, they have the say. You're both willing to surrender the power to them. Which sometimes becomes very useful. And in part two, because very often it ends up being a decision that both of them are not perfectly happy with. Because very often compromise is when neither one is really happy. The problem with compromise is very often when neither is happy, they now blame the other person. But very often with an arbiter, they'll blame the arbiter. Which is why the arbiter has to be someone that's okay with them being angry at them. And I tell many people when I'm doing therapy, where sometimes I do become the arbiter, or doing family therapy, group therapy, organizational consultations, or working with couples, I sometimes tell, part of the luxury of me in this situation is that I'm disposable. You can end up angry at me. Just take my advice. But if you didn't like it, you can blame me, and that's fine. Okay. There's two more steps.
Yeah.
But they only really apply within a church or Christian setting. Does anyone guess what the next step is?
Church discipline.
Hmm?
Church discipline.
Church discipline. Some churches are way too quick to jump into church discipline. Some churches are way, way, way too slow. Partially because one of the issues we often get with church discipline, and one reason church discipline often happens and don't happen more than you know, because it's often handled in private. If it's a public figure, it's supposed to happen in public, but a lot of churches skip the part of it's a public discipline. The bigger issue is there's so many churches. So if someone's behaviors, like, okay, a guy keeps having an affair and refuses to stop, and they're being called out on it. Now, this is the stuff, by the way, that means church discipline. It's clearly sinful behavior. They're clearly doing stuff that's wrong, and they refuse to stop. That's when we move to church discipline. However, there's a lot of churches around, right? So what do you think happens before it gets to that point?
They move on to a new church.
They move on to a different church because we're treating each church as separate. Technically, what's the church supposed to do now? They're technically supposed to tell the next church, which they sometimes do, but the next church usually doesn't necessarily do anything about it. We're so fragmented as churches, and part of the issue is churches. We treat things as churches rather than God's church. Yes. Does anyone know the last step? Again, only applies within Christian circles.
Prayer.
Hmm?
Prayer.
Prayer. You know what? Thank you for saying that, because you should be doing that throughout, right? And this should be a part of the assessment process too. Because you should ask Holy Spirit for guidance in all of this. Absolutely. But the next step is treat as non-believer. Now, but people often think, oh, that's the most severe. And now you can treat them badly or whatever. Oh, now I can yell at them. No. And some people should probably kick into treating them as non-believers before that, because one of the ways we're supposed to approach non-believers is as a mission field. That call to now you treat them as a non-believer is not meant as, oh, so now I can be more self-serving. Because I don't have to apply all of these rules to other believers. No. Now you have to apply it like you're in the mission field. And even if they say they believe in Christ and they're a Christian, and even if they are a Christian at this point, you might be treating them as a non-believer. But that ups the stakes for you. Now the level of self-sacrifice increases even more. Yes. Now, so the last two steps here, they apply largely within a church setting and between believers. All these other steps, they apply even when we go with non-believers. You still go through the steps of negotiation. Actually, one of the things that many people react to with many Christians that are following principles like that, a lot of Christians follow these principles not even realizing they're following outlined steps, is it becomes a mission field itself when you go through a deliberate process. So many relationships get stronger by the fact that they notice that, huh, that person didn't agree with what I'm doing, and they actually did something to help the conflict. We're a consumer culture, right? What do we do if something doesn't work? We throw it, right? Get another one. And guess what? People are used to people doing the same thing with people. People keep getting amazed when things are not working well or things are rubbing the wrong way. People get amazed when Christian goes, I want to work on this. You said something I didn't agree with, and now we're not quite jiving, is not gelling. Let's talk about it. Let's work some things out. It astonishes people. Whenever I confront people in therapy, well, usually when I confront people in therapy, by the way, if you ever come to me for therapy and I do the following, hey, I want to talk with you about something, but first, let's look at the schedule to make sure your appointment's scheduled. You're about to be confronted. Why? Well, it sends just that powerful message, people. People usually mean that any kind of confrontation or talking about difficulties in the relationship or about behaviors, that means I'm severing this relationship and I'm creating distance. No. The point of conflict resolution is reconciliation, which means a deepened relationship. Now, let me point this out. For a relationship to get better and stronger, you can do everything correctly and you can get to the end and things have been resolved. But reconciliation has just begun. Reconciliation can only happen with time and experience. You can't have the big conversation and now you move off to your separate departments or separate things. You now need to spend time together. The only thing that builds trust again and comfort is a combination of time and experience. You see these movies of people falling in love and starting to trust each other? And they've been through all kinds of mayhem and enemies and bad guys in black suits or whatever, right? And they've had a lot of experience together, but they haven't had time together. That doesn't mean they should trust each other, although in the Hollywood movies they usually do. We need to lean into those relationships and we need to spend time with them. Time apart does not heal a relational hurt. But if things are really not gelling and you're coming from different spots, just spending time together usually doesn't heal it either. You need to figure some things out and talk about some stuff. But the blessing of being able to have relationships with people that are not exactly like us or that might be thinking differently would be great. And I know politics these days are not giving us a good model. Politics tell us to choose a side, at least these days. It didn't always used to be that way. So, well, thanks for coming. And now you'll be better equipped to deal with whatever things you don't agree with if you come for my Beatitude session after lunch. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure, just one second.
What percent? We had 100 of them.